Ladies and gentlemen, hello and welcome to the Money Marketing Podcast. My name is Justin Cash. I'm the editor here and your host for today's show, which is, I am pleased to say, a little bit of a switch up on our normal routine. We kicked this off last week because we've been hearing from a lot of our readers, a lot of our listeners, that with lockdown kicking back in, you wanted longer reads to digest at your leisure on the weekend. We have stepped up to the plate, I hope, with a series we are calling Weekend Essays. Last week was the first run of that, where I took a dive into footballers' finances. This week, I'm going to be talking about the new fight over restrictive covenants. Enjoy. Picture the scene. After years as an advisor with St. James's Place, you finally feel the time is right to seek pastures new. You sell your client bank to another SJP partner firm and heartily look forward to your newfound independence. But nearly a decade on, clients are still asking why they can't keep you as their advisor, especially ones who say they've barely heard from their new planner in all the time you've been away. You have to repeatedly explain to them that there's simply nothing you can do. You're legally bound to avoid them at all costs. This is not a fictitious image. It's one an advisor recently came to Money Marketing to ask for a view on. The restrictive covenants they agreed to when leaving SJP are laid out in no uncertain terms. They must, at no point in the future, persuade any clients to transfer out of their SJP products, to cash them in, or to cancel them. They must never try to convince anyone to change advisors or operate under any brand that bears any resemblance at all to the name of their former SJP practice. For 4 years after selling to SJP, they're also barred from working for a competitor or trying to win new business on behalf of a competitor. Unless SJP agrees to it, they can't work as a financial advisor in the same area for 4 years or even promote any products that might be similar to SJP's. Such clauses rarely last into perpetuity, or for as long as these ones from SJP do. But they are by no means an isolated case in the market, and the issues they present are beginning to creep back onto advisors' radars. The week after, another advisor came forward. They're currently at Chase de Vere, but are considering leaving the firm. If they decided to do so, they would be prevented from taking any client or prospective client with them for at least a year, including if they just wanted to reduce the amount of business they did with Chase while remaining a client. The advisor would not be allowed to do anything that would impact negatively on the firm's suppliers or introducers too, and wouldn't be allowed to try and poach staff or work for anyone who would. For 6 months, they wouldn't be allowed to talk with anyone that could potentially be in competition with Chase. These terms may seem pretty uncontroversial for some readers, particularly business owners, who feel they are perfectly understandable for a firm wanting to hold on to its key staff. They may have borne the cost of training or providing leads. It's only fair that an advisor doesn't just take all that good work and use it to make money for someone else. But advisors have clearly felt compelled to discuss their recent experiences, because there are clear reasons why issues around restrictive covenants are coming to the fore again now. The most famous case of advisors trying to break free from the shackles of their contracts dates back to 2011, when Towery took legal action against Raymond James and seven former Edward Jones advisors for $6 million in damages over alleged client solicitation. Towery ended up losing the case. A lot has changed since then. Acquisition and consolidation activity in particular has continued full steam ahead. While brokers Gunner & Co. report a 19% drop in transaction volumes last year amid the COVID-19 pandemic, purchase prices for IFAs have increased by nearly a third over the past 3 years. Gunner is expecting 75% of deal volume to come in the first quarter of this year, suggesting mergers were merely delayed, not axed entirely, and there may be a surge in activity ahead of potential changes to capital gains tax in March's budget. Sellers are increasingly facing pressure on other deal terms outside of pure purchase price, the broker says. This includes the nature of the lock-ins new joiners could be made to sign up to. A fight for the soul of the advice market is raging, between small firms proud of their independence and these bulky restricted brands buying up IFAs, offering them more support if they agree to run their operation on the company's rails. While we have seen some restricted brands grow as the pressures of increased regulation, research and costs become too much for minnows to bear, there are also plenty of cases where the tide has run in the other direction. Independent firms smell an opportunity to pick up quality advisors who have become disenchanted with increasingly rapid strides towards vertical integration, as well as in-house fund ranges and productivity targets taking precedence over client care. If you're a financial advisor and worried about your future, or you're concerned about your independence being taken from you, then check out our client website. Reads a recent advert from Carlisle-based advisors Truly Independent posted on LinkedIn. In a recent poll of money marketing readers, 81% said that they thought restrictive covenants lasting more than a year were not appropriate for advisors. At the back end of last year, a High Court judge dismissed claims that an ex-advisor at Quilter Private Client Advisors breached restrictive covenants in her contract because the covenants themselves were found to be unlawful. The 12-month lock-ins amounted to an invalid restraint of trade and went beyond the legitimate protection of business interests, it was ruled. Plenty also have grievances over how such restrictive covenants are enforced when they take the decision to leave. The legal costs of taking an ex-advisor to task can often outweigh the loss of income from any clients that would follow them. Quilter's claim was said to amount to some £39,000, but it shelled out nearly £500,000 in case fees. But that has not stopped some firms building a reputation for pursuing the letter of their terms to the fullest. The restrictions, in my view, would have no chance of standing up in court at the time they were written, and most certainly not now, a source from the world of advisor acquisitions says of the SJP contract terms. SJP, possibly wary of the threat of legal challenge, builds in specific clauses around what to do should one occur. In its template partnership agreement, advisors explicitly agree that the termination clauses are for the protection of the legitimate business interests of the partner firm and are reasonable in all circumstances. It retains the right to enforce any of the lock-in clauses if one of them is ruled non-enforceable. In the agreement regarding a client bank sale that the advisor reported to Money Marketing, it says the parties all agree the terms are reasonable, but if any judgment says otherwise, they can just delete the offending section of the clause and continue to apply its terms. There are a host of perfectly solid arguments for imposing restrictive covenants on departing advisors. Otherwise, their use would not be so widespread across the profession. That clients are still sounding out their old advisor about changing shop many years after the individual has left highlights the importance of the personal, rather than firm level, relationships advisors make. It also shines a light on the risks to a firm's commercial model if clients aren't quite as sticky as they originally assumed. It's why modern acquisition models normally have a 2-year earn-out after a business is bought. Withholding part of the full deal value if the planner and their clients do not stick around for at least 24 months is one way to ensure they have a financial incentive to see the purchase through and continue looking after clients. Selling a client bank, rather than just exiting a firm for another one, also throws up a fairness imperative for the buyer. Having pocketed hundreds of thousands of pounds for agreeing to give your clients away to another advisor, it only seems right that you're stopped from going straight back and reclaiming them for free. The seller cannot have their cake then eat it too, any rational buyer would agree. The replacement advisor would need time to get up to speed before a client can make an informed decision as to whether they're still best served by the firm, or whether they should follow their old planner to greener grass. Putting a restrictive covenant in place ensures that there will at least be a few months for the new kid on the block to catch up. To a certain extent, restrictive covenants do also stop client churning. An advisor can't take old business and pretend that it's new by rewriting it at their new firm, charging a second initial fee a matter of months after the original recommendation. Business owners also have to ask themselves a serious question. How could former clients have been solicited unless the departing advisor had committed a data breach? Otherwise, how would the advisor know who to solicit and where to contact them? While they can't police every bit of personal information, restrictive covenants are a safeguard against an advisor making liberal use of the scanner on their way out of the door. From the extent of phoenixing that goes on in the financial planning profession, we are all too aware that there are plenty of individuals who will happily run away from their responsibilities if they sense the regulatory mood music has turned against them. Having contractual clawback mechanisms to cover previous unsuitable advice is a way to guarantee at least part of the accountability sits with the person who caused the problem in the first place. There may well be a period where they remain tied to their own company for this very reason. But all of the above cannot fully counterweight the pressures on restrictive covenants from multiple avenues in the modern planning world. For starters, the regulatory view is one that jars with much of the lived experience of advisors looking to set up new shops, particularly ones away from major national or restricted brands. The FCA, with a new competition objective under its belt, has repeatedly called for greater choice between opposing advisors for clients. How would it view a restrictive covenant which demands that, instead of being able to increase competition by setting up elsewhere, you can't practice at all as an advisor in the same region for at least 4 years? We all know how geographically bound advice in the UK is. Local firms are the lifeblood of their communities. Not being able to set up anywhere near where you were is a death sentence if you ever want those clients to meet you in person again. Combined with rules that say you cannot promote financial services products either for many years, you're also effectively stopping a departing advisor from becoming a business development manager, a sales manager, or a consultant in the wider financial services world, rendering their options truly limited. To revert to the legal terminology of our court cases, what would be the legitimate business interest in stopping an advisor even taking on an ancillary role in a financial services firm that is barely related to their former advisory haunt? Yet, on a strict reading, that is exactly what some contractual clauses do today. The greatest challenge, however, relates to suitability. If clients want to move, and their former advisor can now offer them a better deal, is it really the job of their former firm to prevent them doing so? Particularly if a business had moved to a model where it was clear clients were advised by the firm, rather than the individual, clients should be proactively choosing to stay because of your first-rate service and proposition, not just because the only other home that they would trust is blocked off from them. This was a theme that filtered through some of the FCA's recent work on platform exit fees, for example. That it would be inappropriate if clients were unable to get a better deal just because the costs of moving were so punitive. It's also an issue that the watchdog has flagged in its recent work on consumer investment outcomes, where it found a significant proportion of consumers were paying for ongoing advice, but weren't actually receiving a proper service. Some who paid more for ongoing service than their peers didn't end up receiving anything different as a result. Plenty of those involved in the consolidation space, for example, have reported cases where large firms are more focused on onboarding and transitioning to a new firm after making an acquisition than what to do once the clients actually get there. If some of a firm's clients are part of that unlucky group, should they be barred from seeing an advisor who was part of that model, but now wants to do things differently? It will be up to the folks at Stratford, and planning bosses themselves, to decide where to draw the line going forward. Rest assured, we have not seen the end of the debate around restrictive covenants, though. thanks so much for listening to today's episode of the podcast. I've been Justin Cash, editor of Money Marketing, and your host. If you like what we're doing with this new weekend essays format, just drop us a line and let us know. The more people listen, the more likely we are to keep doing them. So make sure you're subscribed on Spotify, on Apple, on Podbean, any good podcast player, basically. And check out the Money Marketing website for the full written version of these stories. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time.